This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves, Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Nelson DeMille, who died on September 17, 2024, at the age of 81, was one of the leading best-selling authors from the 1980s into the 21st century. Among his novels are The General's Daughter, The Gold Coast, Plum Island, and Word of Honor. Three of his novels were turned into films. On June 13, 1997, Richard A. Lupoff and I interviewed Nelson DeMille while he was on tour for Plum Island. In the discussion, we focused on that book as well as several others.
Plum Island is about 500 pages, General's Daughter about the same, Gold Coast about 700 pages. These are very long books. Why do you write such long books?
There's a natural, I think, flow of a book. I can't tell a story in a shorter form. I really tried, and not because the editor said these are too long or readers said these are too long, just because I would like to get a book. I mean, some of the great classics like 1984 and whatever, they didn't run 120, 130 pages. Eight books now, actually, and they've all come in at the same word count, if you will, between 200,000 and 250,000 words. So I seem unable for some reason. I really can't explain it to write shorter.
Do you enjoy taking the time? I mean, is that what's going on?
No, not at all. It's I don't really like the writing process. I like having written, but I don't like writing. Even when I plot them out and I say, this is going to be a quickie, this is 100,000 words, this is, for instance, should be half my normal length, somehow the characters take over, and a lot of it is dialogue, though. It is, so the pages are kind of open, it's not dense narrative, it's a lot of open dialogue, which I think brings up the word count, or the page count, I should say. There's a way to do these things shorter, but see, if you're doing characters, and you're doing plot, and you're doing ambiance, I do a lot of ambiance, my books have a lot of ambiance, and you gotta put all that in there in a certain balance, so to speak. And by the time you're done, it's 200,000 words.
Nothing against either General's Daughter or Plum Island, but The Gold Coast is a spectacular book. How did it come to be written, and were you expecting to write a thriller and wrote this book instead, or what?
No, I actually started out trying to take on Scott Fitzgerald. The Gold Coast is set on Long Island's Gold Coast, where The Great Gatsby was set. And the way it came about is one of my British editors came out to Long Island once. He said, I'd love to see Fitzgerald territory. So I didn't know where that was, but I thought I knew what he was talking about. So I said, yeah, okay. So we went up to the estates on Long Island's what we call the Gold Coast, which is where the Vanderbilts, Roosevelts, Rockefellers live. And I realized that there was this fact, and I lived there all my life, and when you live close to something, like you live near the Eiffel Tower, you never look at it. And I lived near the Gold Coast all my life. I never really thought about it in terms of a possible background for a book. So then I thought about it. I read Fitzgerald again. I read Gatsby, and I kind of decided, let me do a modern version of Gatsby. And in fact, the New York Times, and actually it was Kirkus Reviews, said that in many, many ways this was better than Fitzgerald's Gatsby. I mean, what more can you ask for? They actually said that.
Just so long as you don't say it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it, but I can repeat it.
Well, the one of the comments there is it's The Great Gatsby meets The Godfather.
Right.
Though he's less The Godfather and I think more a little more John Gotti.
Yeah. I based the character of the Don Bellarosa on kind of a composite of a lot of people. There are a lot of mafia who live on Long Island's North Shore now. It's kind of... It's ironic. These were the homes of the Fortune 500 at the turn of the century, and a lot of them have been sold to new money, Iranian refugees, mafia people who are into probably pharmaceuticals of some sort. But yet the old WASP families are still there. So you're getting this kind of situation where you have people who, you know, your next door neighbor could be no longer a member of the Fortune 500, but somebody else.
What it amounts to is a culture clash. But rather than an inner city where you have blacks and Hispanics or Asian immigrants or other groups, very poor people competing for the crumbs of society, you have billionaires. But do you still get the same kind of stuff going on?
Yeah. these people, you know, the nouveau riche who come to a place like Long Island's Gold Coast, they're not going to get into the country club for sure. So you really have two societies going on there. These people are looking for privacy, looking for security too. These are often gated communities. I mean, gated estates. So you have a situation. The thing they have in common is that they're rich, but how they made their money and how old that money is are two different things. And, you know, East Coast money tends to be old. Some of this money, and these families, the guests, the Morgans go back a long time, and they consider themselves, you know, the American aristocracy. And here they are sharing turf with people who whose fortunes have some suspicious origin. But the old money's fortunes all had suspicious origins anyway. You go back to, you know, post-Civil War, a lot of this money was, you know, it was robber baron money. But it just depends on how old the money is.
Well, that's something that has fascinated me for a long time, and I'd like you to address it. We have the notion, if we look and think about these things, that in a certain sense, all money is good. It's better to be rich than to be poor, to borrow an aphorism. But all money is not equally good. Old money is better than new money, and money derived from source A is better than money derived from source B.
Yeah, I mean, some of the money, you know, they say behind every great fortune is a crime. And probably with the robber barons, it was true, and certainly with a lot of the people, you know, the nouveau riche in American society, especially East Coast. Some of it is clearly illegal money, but some of it is just made doing something that the old families wouldn't even consider doing, whether it be stockbrokering, that kind of thing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the money. It's just that it's no, well, only a chain, even better, only a chain of convenience stores. On a chain of convenience stores, and you're very wealthy, and you move to the to Long Island's Gold Coast. Well, the Vanderbilt next door doesn't really want, or the Esther next door. But the Esters, of course, own hotels at one time. So, you know, it depends. Money takes on a patina the further you get away from its source.
In the Gold Coast, and actually also Plum Island, you deal strongly with architecture. And I know Dick wants to talk a little about that element of Plum Island a little later. But in the Gold Coast, you describe, in particular, two mansions. The mansion that has been abandoned by our protagonist and his wife who live in the guest house. I don't recall the name of that mansion right now.
Something Hall.
And the other is the Alhambra, which is right. Almost sound, looks like a museum. And the Godfather lives there and isn't quite sure what room is what,
right.
Which produces one of the funnier scenes in the book, one of the many, many funny scenes in the book, which, incidentally, is an extremely funny book.
Thank you.
Do those particular houses exist? And if they don't, what are they based on?
No, those don't particularly. Those themselves, I do, but they're based on. There's a couple of books on Long Island, on the Long Island North Shore. One is called Beaux-Arts of Long Island. Another one is called The Gold Coast of Long Island, Art and Architecture. And these are fantastic. These are the equivalent of Newport Mansions and Bar Harbor Mansions. This was a golden age from, I say, end of Civil War, where you see a progression. The mansion started out as these huge, big clapboard things at the end of the Civil War. They still had this aura of Americana around them, but by the turn of the century, they turned to granite, they turned to marble. The Long Island rich would go to Europe and buy whole libraries, including the paneling, and they would buy marble fireplaces from Venice, and they basically, with their money, looted a lot of Europe. And after World War I, when especially the English were down and broke, Americans would go. The Americans who made fortunes during World War I would buy the contents and the even the walls of and fireplaces of these great old English manor houses and brought them to America. So we have all, you know, because of this, you know, kind of bulldozer effect of money, a lot of Europe is concentrated in Newport and Bar Harbor and Gold Coast and Long Island.
There seems to be a number of abandoned mansions of that sort, certainly in your book. Is that also the case?
Yeah, some of them are still abandoned. They're hard to find. It's hard to find use for a 75-room house. you can make it into hotel. You know, to retrofit a house like that is expensive, and yet sometimes to tear them down because some of them really are granite. So they sit there. These are these huge white elephants. A lot of them are institutions. Some of them are still in the same family and are being actually lived in. I knew a Grace, and she was by herself, lived in a 75-room mansion with a staff of about 9 or 10. The staffs, typically, though, at the turn of the century were like 50 or 60 people. But the world has changed, and even the rich today, the old rich, don't really want to live in these things. They're too ostentatious. It's the new rich. It's the godfathers and the drug dealers who, if they can launder the money, want that ostentation.
Oh, one more question before we move on to Plum Island. Concerning the Gold Coast, is another section of the book involves the protagonist and his wife who engage in various forms of kinky sex. Probably one of the more interesting marriages. I guess I'm not sure how to phrase this, so I think you understand my question.
Yeah, I had a, almost all of my books, I think, and if I thought about them, the protagonist and the lead female character are not married. Here I had a situation where they were married, and this presented a problem, because nothing kills sex like marriage. So I had to do something different with them. Most marriages that we read about in novels are dying and, they're asexual. So I said, let me do something different. Let me actually have them have a good sex life.
Are there any Roman ruins, fake Roman ruins like there are in?
Yeah, it was a style at the turn of the century to actually build ruins as ruins, Roman ruins. And I'm a frustrated architect. If I had it to do over again, I probably would have become. I was always fascinated by architecture, and as you mentioned, you can see it in my books. People read it who are not interested in architecture. It's like, can we get rid of the architecture? Just get on to the story and the plot. But I think people are influenced by their surroundings. People who live in a desert are going to, when you're telling a story of people who live in a desert, you're not telling a story about people who live on the Gold Coast of Long Island or who live in Florida. People are products of their environment. They're not products of anything else. They're products of their environment. This is what they see every day. And this is the milieu that they live in. If you were writing a book set in Rome in 1000 AD, you would have a deserted city of 2 million people. And the people who lived in this once huge city would react to their environment. We all react to our environment.
Dick Lupoff.
Well, I must say that the sense of place in Plum Island is at least as important as the story itself, which is not to demean the story. Would you, Nelson DeMille, tell us just what Plum Island is and just where it is?
Yeah, Plum Island. There's actually two Plum Islands. One is in Maine. This is not to be confused with the one in Maine. This one is in off the coast of Long Island. It lies in Long Island Sound and with Connecticut to the north and Orient Point on Long Island to the south. It's founded by the Dutch about 16, or discovered by the Dutch around 1650. More recently, it is an animal disease research center. It's sort of the animal equivalent of the CDC in Atlanta, Center for Disease Control. And it's under the Department of Agriculture now. But during the 50s, it was an army installation. And in fact, it had been an army installation since the Spanish-American War when it was an artillery fort to guard New York Harbor, although it's about 90 miles from New York. But in the 50s, when it was under the Department of the Army, it was a biological warfare research center. Now it's supposed to be a disease, animal disease research center where they study anthrax, mad cow disease, hoof and mouth disease. But the local rumor has always been that the Army never really left, that what goes on there is biological warfare research. It's one of the few places in the country, I think there's only three, that has a zone, a biocontainment zone 4, which is the hot zone. Atlanta has one, Plum Island has one, I think there may be one other on the west coast. So that kind of state-of-the-art facility, I don't think it's just for animals only. I think it is probably being, at least the work product is being used by the biological warfare people in the Army.
Your protagonist, John Corey, winds up on Plum Island in the course of the narrative. In fact, he winds up there more than once. We don't want to give away too much of the plot. But on at least one of these visits, he gets a very, very extensive guided tour of the place. Yeah. Did you have such a tour?
I did, yeah. At one time, nobody could get on that island. Even if we had a congressman who wanted to do a congressional investigation back in the 70s, 80s, and he had trouble getting on the island. By them saying nobody's allowed on this island for any reason ever, it just fueled the rumor mill.
Of course.
So now they have a better idea. If you have a good reason, you write to the Department of Agriculture in Washington and you write to the director of Plum Island directly, you can usually get permission to tour the island. But this is like inspecting a nuclear research facility. You don't know what you're seeing. I mean, the guy's working on anthrax there, and he's working on anthrax for, you know, legitimate reasons. But anthrax, you know, crosses a species barrier and can be used for biological warfare. So, yeah, I did get a tour. I got a fairly extensive tour. Did not go into biocontainment 4, did not want to go into biocontainment 4. Went into biocontainment 1 and 2, and you have to shower out afterward. It was interesting, and they were very polite and very helpful. And when I asked them questions like, what happens to your work product? Who sees the work product? Are you working on Ebola? You know, the answer to that was no. What happens to your work product? The answer was it's strictly animal disease. But you have to wonder. I mean, the rumors have been there. Because in the 50s, there was a biological warfare research center, and they always denied that. Under the Freedom of Information Act, they finally admitted that it was.
The director of the lab, remind me of his name?
Zollner.
Zollner. Fascinating. I love that term. Sort of like Dr. Strangelove for the 90s. Right. Talk about this fellow. Just an amazing guy.
Yeah. Well, the real director of the lab is actually from Colombia, and the director before him was from England. I didn't want to represent either of these two fellows who are, you know, brilliant scientists and do great work. But I decided to make this guy a foreigner. And what better foreigner than a German? Because, I mean, I'm sure the word Strangelove popped in my mind when I was writing the piece. It's a tough job. I mean, nobody lives on the island, so you've got to commute to this thing. And then when you go into biocontainment, you're there for 10 or 12 hours. You don't leave, because to leave means stripping and showering down and showering out every time. In many ways, a thankless job, because anything that's secret is thankless. And, you know, nobody knows what great things they're doing there or what bad things they're doing there. Probably underpaid, overworked, typical, you know, and they have the added responsibility of security, because this place is ripe. I mean, ripe for a terrorist attack. There's very little security on this island. If this was a nuclear facility, there'd be guards all over the place. There wasn't that many guards. There wasn't as many guards as I represented in the novel. And yet here you have some of the most scary pathogens that exist in the universe on an island, basically unguarded. There is some security there. So this guy, the director of the lab, has the added responsibility. This is not a lab to come up with a new, you know, a new flavor, a new color. This is a lab that deals with pathogens that are so virulent that they're not even allowed on the mainland, which is why, by the way, this is all done on an island.
Corey, in the course of this book, you can feel how creepy he thinks the whole island is. Was that the impression of Nelson DeMille?
No, that was the impression of Nelson DeMille, the person, was that this was an okay place. It looked fine. But for the purposes of the novel, we had to make it a little more creepy. It can be creepy, because when you see it, you know, when you sail around it in foggy weather, it looks like the island of Dr. Moreau sitting there. Islands by themselves, you know. There's something about an island, you know, and I think that appeals to, you know, to all of us, being on the water and sailing toward an island. We know this is a small island. We know that something is going on there. The facility itself is a little creepy. Yeah, the island is actually pristine, which is incredible, because nobody lives there. There's no artillery force, which is ruined, and it's kind of neat. But the island has meadows and wetlands and birds sing. But, you know, back in the 80s, before all the animals are now in biocontainment too. Back in the 80s, they actually had them grazing, and there was a biocontainment leak, the first one that ever happened. And almost everything out in the fields died. I mean, everything died, and they had to burn these carcasses. And I think maybe it's more creepy because it looks so benign, it looks so earthy, but on this big island, this facility, which is state-of-the-art, high-tech, which you wouldn't expect. If you were walking through the woods, you came upon this thing, you'd say, what the hell is this? It looks like something out of James Bond. That itself is a little creepy when you get into that environment, because that environment is totally without windows, totally enclosed.
Well, one character makes a comment that if there were a major earthquake, it would be a war between whether you'd be gotten by the bugs of Plum Island or by the nuclear waste of the New London nuclear power plant.
Right.
Did someone actually say that?
Yeah, somebody mentioned that. And then and the real fear there, earthquakes, thank God, not as common there as they are here, but... We have hurricanes. We have, you know, and as you know, Richard, if you lived on Long Island once, this is Hurricane Alley, and hurricanes have missed this island. I mean, for the last, you know, 50 years since this facility has been there, if you had a hurricane and the generators went down, you would have biocontainment leak, and it would be really awful because once electricity is gone, all your negative, the place is a negative airflow environment. There's more air pressure on the outside than the inside. It's like 13 pounds per square inch inside the building, so that air only rushes in, nothing can rush out. But once you lose the electricity, none of the virus scrubbers work or any of the stuff that keeps this place from, you know, becoming dirty. Same with the New London nuclear plant. More probably with a potential earthquake. There are earthquakes on the East Coast, but also a hurricane. But this is the modern world. One of the characters in the book says, the modern world is full of unimaginable horrors, including, you know, nuclear facilities and biotech labs.
The world we're living in, you use the term the modern world, which of course has changed dramatically in our lifetime. Specifically, for decades, we lived under the terror of incoming bombers and or missiles with nuclear warheads, and now it looks as if we don't have to worry, probably don't have to worry about that. Nothing is guaranteed. But either an environmental contamination through various toxins or the spread of disease, in quotation marks, new diseases, seems to be looming as a major concern.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is... You know, in 1918, after World War I, there was the influenza outbreak that killed maybe 20 million people worldwide. That was the last major, in quotes, plague that this world has seen. And this was 20 million people at a time when there was almost no travel, even between towns and cities. I mean, today, theoretically, a very virulent disease starting someplace will spread around the globe in less than 48 hours because of jet planes. The irony of something like Ebola is that it's so deadly that it kills everybody in the village before it has a chance to spread. But the worst type of disease that could be coming out of the rainforest is something that's more slow-acting that will infect most of the population. You don't want to sound like an alarmist, but either through bioterrorism or just through natural means, and also genetic alterations and accident in the lab, there's stuff out there. I mean, this is what kills people. I mean, nuclear weapons can kill people. As you say, the threat is almost nil at this point. Microorganisms are scary because you don't see them, you don't smell them, you don't taste them, and there they are, and they're infecting people. And if it was an act of bioterrorism, and in fact, in Plum Island, I say, which is true, is we took a can of anthrax, a coffee can of anthrax, and sailed around Manhattan Island to bring it home, sailed around San Francisco Bay, and vaporize it into the air, you'd kill about 200,000 people. And this is not high-tech stuff. This is not like, you know, nuclear. This is home lab kind of stuff. Anthrax is home lab. You get a little anthrax organism, and you can make more and more anthrax. The stuff grows. I mean, it's got a potential of being able to be reproduced ad infinitum.
Nelson DeMille, okay, I've read these three books. They're all... very well researched, particularly in areas that normally you would not see someone doing the research. Plum Island, you got on the island.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
One of my books, Charm School, I had to go to Moscow for in 1987. It was 86, right after Chernobyl. And, you know, sometimes I might send my next book to the Caribbean, I think, do the research there. Yeah, the research is tough, and I don't write the same book every time like some writers. And so it's like doing a doctorate every year and a half. I kind of enjoy the research. It's interesting. I do most of my research by what I call field research, going to the area or by interviewing people. You interview doctors, interview airline pilots, interview who you have to interview.
How did you do the research? General's Daughter is a very unusual sort of book. It's a military police procedural. How did you do the research to find out exactly how the military cops would try to solve a homicide?
Yeah, I was in the military for 3 years, but it had changed considerably. I was in the Vietnam era, and I was writing this book during the Gulf War era. I was right post-Gulf War, and I couldn't believe how much the military changed. I simply got a hold of CID guys. I mean, this is the best kind of research. You can read books. It doesn't mean anything. And you can't get out of a book where you get out of a human being who's actually lived the job. And you know, one of the advantages of being a best-selling author is it's easier to get into touch with people who want to talk. And I talked to two CID guys, and I said, "How would you research this?" And then I thought I had a book. Then I said, "You know, I'm sure there's women in CID. This was harder to find." I finally found a woman who was in CID, and I got her. You know, which is a slightly different viewpoint of how do you go about solving a rape murder. But that was it. It was the crux of the research was people who had actually done the job. They were retired. People who are on the job, you got to be a little careful because they're filtering everything. I interviewed an airline pilot once about airline disasters, and he was filtering everything. When I interviewed a retired airline pilot, I got a whole different thing. Retired people who have nothing better to do than to talk to authors, the absolute best source of information.
Dick Lupa.
Well, let's get back to Plum Island and the MacGuffin and the mechanism that Nelson Jamil used as a novelist. Some people, critics of the mystery field, say that the whodunit is really a misnomer, that various authors are much more interested in how done it and why done it. And certainly the fulcrum of Plum Island is the why done it.
Yeah.
How did that work? I mean, as far as how, there's no secret. The book opens with a double murder, and
yeah,
they were shot. That's no mystery. But the book really is all built about why did this murder take place?
Yeah, and I'm not a mystery writer. This is my second foray into the mystery field. The first one was General's Daughter. My other seven books. I have nine, actually. Okay, the other seven were not. So it was new. It's still new to me. And you read whodunits. We read them for pleasure. And it looks simple on the surface, but having just written one, I tell you, it's not so simple. And that's what you have to decide too: is it a clever murder, or is it? I think the most interesting is the why. Why was it done? You see two people. It starts with a man and wife who were both scientists on Plum Island, who were found murdered on the back deck of their house by the bay. And because there was some Plum Island sign, it looks like a burglary gone wrong, but we know it's not a burglary gone wrong. We know that they were killed because, we think we know they were killed because of their work. And everybody, you know, follows that trail for about half of the book. They were killed, definitely, everybody thinks, because they're either selling a vaccine for Ebola, which is going to make them a fortune, or they were selling a biological warfare organism to a terrorist state or a terrorist organization. Well, they might have even been running drugs because it's a maritime situation, you know, where they have there's boats and there is drug running on the east end of Long Island. So, you know, you have three whys. But our hero, this is where the clever guy comes in. The clever guy, John Corey, is a homicide dick, says, it's none of the above. I don't know what it is, but it's something else. And this, I think, is what compels the reader to go on, because they're following the guy. It's a first-person narrative. They're following him. When you're doing a whodunit, it's always good to do a first-person narrative because you want to follow this guy's thought processes. He's just eliminated the three most obvious and most, you know, logical reasons why these people were killed. And he says, I don't know why, but it wasn't these things. And, of course, by that time, the reader should be wanting to read the rest of it.
Indeed. Corey himself is a very interesting, very cantankerous, difficult guy. He is an actual official homicide detective, but from another jurisdiction, right. Who's on convalescent leave after being wounded in the line of duty. I noticed in the book that he compared himself at one point to Columbo, the Peter Falk character. But as I was reading, I kept thinking Travis McGee.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, he does a Columbo routine. John Corey is really, really typical of a New York City homicide cop. I know enough of them. I didn't try to do anything different. I didn't make him a violin player or give him any other quirks. The man is as simple. He drinks beer and he likes to solve homicides. And he's about as straightforward as they come. But his complexities lie, I think, in maybe not getting too psychobabbly. He knows himself, but I think he doesn't know. Especially, as you mentioned, he's in a different jurisdiction. When he was in New York City, he knew his milieu. But it's always a great device to take somebody out of their milieu, your convalescing cop out in the hinterlands. And I think his complexities may lie in his self-awareness that he doesn't really know exactly what's going on around him, but he knows he doesn't know, which is, you know, a sign of any bright guy. He's also got a keen mind in terms of reading people, and that travels well no matter where you are. He's no different than a lot of other cops. Maybe the thing that makes him a little bit different is he's funny. He's a wisecracking main character. And when you do the first person, the reader's got to stay with you for the whole book. I mean, this is one guy carrying the book, basically. Editors don't like first person, say that suicide notes are written in the first person. And you got to be careful when you use first person.
Is there a particular personality type who is drawn into the profession of being a homicide detective?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, sure. It's like any other profession. You know, it's self-selecting. I mean, most of us would not go into police work of any sort. We don't want to carry a gun. We don't want to be authority figures. But the ones who do are there for that reason, and the ones who are brighter go on to detective work, and eventually the pinnacle of detective work is homicide.
Is there something about them? Do you detect some particular glowing spark inside of these guys that makes them different from 99% of the rest of the population?
Well, that's a good question. And my character, John Corey, gives a little bit of a clue when he says that he wanted to be an archaeologist when he was a kid. He found a musket ball, and he wanted to dig up secrets and reproduce what life might have been like 200 years ago on Long Island. So there's a clue to the mind that tends toward ratiocination. The cops that I've interviewed, some of them actually have a strong moral streak. They don't like crime. They don't like people getting away with something. The other kind of cop is, and especially when you get to the elite ranks of homicide detectives, are pleased to solve mysteries. And I think this is why readers like to read mystery books, because they want to solve it too. Jacques Bazin once said that the soul of the spy is somehow the model of us all. But you could also say that the soul of the homicide detective is somehow the model of us all. Nobody who doesn't love to take the pieces of the puzzle and come up with a solution and say, without anybody telling me this is what happened, everybody's lying to me, and all the evidence has been messed around with, tampered with, and with all that going on, I know the truth. Most Americans, believe in truth and justice. So this guy has become the modern hero, not the spy anymore because the Cold War is over, not the soldier that used to be a hero, maybe 50 years ago in society. Maybe the hero now is the guy who's in law enforcement, who gets to the truth of some heinous crime or even not heinous crime. Police work is endlessly fascinating. I mean, when Arthur Conan Doyle wrote Sherlock Holmes, which was one of the first, it captured the imagination of the whole world. Here's a detective who, which was a new profession then, he was the world's first consulting detective, Sherlock Holmes, and he took pieces of puzzles and listened to people's lies, and he came out with, at the end of the day, with the truth.
Question then is whether we're going to see John Corey again.
I haven't brought any of my characters back, and I tell you the truth, I get tired of them. Some people, like Dirk Pitt comes back time after time as Kessler, and there's been no sequels in my writing, and there probably would never be a sequel. He's an interesting character, but I've said everything I have to say about him. To bring him back means to kind of reintroduce him, and as a writer, from a technical standpoint, you don't know where to stop been reintroducing because you become redundant. You can't assume that everybody's read the first book, and yet you can assume some people have. So where do how much do you want to talk about John Corey again? This was a carefully built character, brick by brick by brick, and at the end of the day, you knew the man and you knew everything you wanted to know about him, and then it was finished. To try to do that again is like taking this house that you built out of bricks, taking the whole thing down, or taking part of it down, and so to try to do it again, but you don't have to do everything again, but how much you have to do and how much you don't have to do. Sequels are tough. I don't know why people use the same characters, although, having said that, there is Sherlock Holmes, and there are exceptions to that.
Of course there are. Richard Walensky.
Nelson DeMille, you've written, eight novels. Of those eight novels, now I have not read most of them, but when I remarked to you how the Gold Coast was not to put down the summer reading of Plum Island or General's Daughter, several cuts above, you also mentioned that in the same vein, Word of Honor is also.
Yeah. I was in Vietnam. I was with the 1st Cavalry Division in 1968 during the Tet Offensive. I was a combat infantry officer, basically, and I was there during the Battle of Khe Sanh and Battle of Asha Valley and all these blasts from the past that we remember. And I came back and wanted to write the Great American War novel. Me and Norman Mailer were going to write, and he already wrote his, and I was going to write mine. But nobody was interested. And years later, 16 years went by, I think it was, and I decided to get back to the Vietnam theme, because I had never minded the way Hemingway, for instance, had mined his war experiences. And the 16 years that went by, I think, gave me a good perspective on the war and on the people who were in it. So what Word of Honor is about is a man 16 years after Vietnam ends who was a platoon leader living an upper-middle-class lifestyle on Long Island in a comfortable suburbs, wife, child, and he has a job with an aircraft company, aircraft parts company. Anyway, somebody writes a book about the Battle of Hue during the Tet Offensive, and in the book it mentions our hero, Ben Tyson, who was a platoon leader whose platoon massacred a hospital full of men, women, children, nuns, doctors, 16 years before during the height of the Tet Offensive. So here's a man whose life is all of a sudden turned upside down. And it was a serious book. Yeah, it was meant to be a serious book. And I think everybody can relate to the skeleton in the closet. We all have one. It might not be the magnitude of massacring a hospital full of people. It might be just simply cheating on our income tax. But nobody wants to hear about it 16 years later. Then you have the age-old question like you had with the Holocaust is when can you forgive? When can you forget? I mean, the person who did this in 1968, who was 22 years old, is now 40 years old, and he's a father and a husband. Is he as liable and culpable as that other guy who was really the same guy? And I happen to think the answer is yes. But, you know, if you've done something, if you're a Nazi who worked in a concentration camp in 1945, it doesn't matter that it's 1997, 98, you've got to pay the price. It might not be the same high price you would have paid, you know, in 45. But this is what the book was about. It was about guilt and also about the psychosis of war, things that people do in a war situation that they would not ever do back in the civilization. But the scary thing is that in a civil society, we're one person, but we go to war, and we have the capability of committing mass murder. Many people do.
You've written these two serious novels. When can we expect another serious Nelson DeMille novel?
Oh, there's the $64 question. Actually, I just went back to Vietnam after 29 years, and I went back with two other combat vets, and it was a really emotional experience, and that's what I'm working on now. I'm working on the idea of three middle-aged guys 29 years after Vietnam who also combat go back to Vietnam. I don't have a plot. I don't have – I mean, I have the premise – what these guys do, what they find, what is their purpose, and what are they trying to discover? But I think when I – this book, I feel, even without an outline, if I sat down and began it, it would probably write itself.
And it would not be a thriller, quote-unquote.
No. This is serious. It's a serious subject. I mean, there's so many – it's about 2 million veterans of Vietnam, and probably 90% of them want to go back. Every time I talk to somebody who's a veteran, I say, I just went back. They say, oh, God, I wish I could go back. I mean, there's 2 million people who want closure on this thing. I mean, when I left in 68, that place was frozen in time for me. It was 1968. The country was in ruins and in flames. I go back now, and I see that the country's at peace. These people seem relatively happy. Almost everything has been rebuilt, which is incredible. And now I was able to get on. This place is no longer frozen in 68. My more vivid memories is of this new country of mostly young people. About 25 million people have been born since the war, and it's got some dynamics. And it was good for me personally. It's the most, you know, all these psychoanalysis you're going to do to try to forget, you know, whatever happened to Vietnam is not the same, I think, as going back into the belly of the beast and meeting it head on. And we didn't know how we were going to feel, and we went through the cathartic period, we went through the really emotional tears and everything. But after that, it was like, you know, when we left and we flew to Bangkok and we had a drink, and I think we all felt this was the best thing we had done, and we should have done it earlier, actually. So this is a serious subject that I did, and this is a serious book. And, you know, the publisher will go along with this. Sometimes you get a little editorial resistance because he said, you know, look, you're making a lot of money writing thrillers. But if you come up with the right kind of subject, people in the, you know, my editor would say, this is the book you have to write. A memoir would be much easier to write than to novelize the experience. But I don't know that for a fact. This is something, I think in a form of a novel, you can make deeper explorations because you write 9 novels and then now you're trying to become a reporter doing nonfiction in my memoir, maybe even stretch the truth. Novelists are not good reporters. A really good reporter goes and he reports what he sees, what he hears, he triangulates his information. And I think that I would be too tempted to color some of the stuff or to have thought or to write something that I didn't think about at the time but thought about afterward. So to be honest to it, you almost have to do it in fiction form. And I think fiction gives you a lot more latitude to explore other people's feelings besides my own.
Nelson DeMille would return to John Corey from Plum Island in The Lion's Game in 2000 and in several other novels. He returned to the character of Paul Brenner from The General's Daughter in Up Country in 2002. In all, there would be 27 novels, plus 2 written in collaboration with his son, Alex DeMille, 2 early novels written under a pseudonym, plus several works of short fiction. 3 of his books, most notably The General's Daughter, became films. You've been listening to an interview with the late novelist Nelson DeMille, who died on September 17, 2024, at the age of 81. It was recorded June 13, 1997, while he was on tour for his novel, Plum Island. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff. Nelson DeMille would return to the KPFA studios during a tour for his novel, Up Country, in 2002. This interview was digitized, remastered, and edited in November 2024 and has not been heard in over 25 years. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.